for the correlation function, for spin-spin correlation function in the Ising model, has the following form: sum over L delta I L minus 1 over T J I L G L J is equal to delta I J. So you can think of this equation as, so we'll see later that there is a very close analogy between this functional integral theory that we are developing for the Ising model and the Klein-Gordon theory in quantum field theories. As I understand, you are studying exactly that now. So this would be then a discrete analog of the Klein-Gordon equation. Okay? So it's not obvious right now, but you will see the analogy later. So the way we can solve this is by, as we were discussing last time, by Fourier transform, right? And that's always the case when you have something that's translationally invariant in space, right? You can always solve this problem by Fourier transform. So let me again go through some of the details of how I define the Fourier transform. So I define Fourier transform of my fields, phi I, as 1 over square root of n, sum over k, phi k e to I k dot ri. And I will always use the same letter for, the function in real space and its Fourier transform. The distinction is going to be in the arguments. Okay, and it never presents any problems. Okay. So as we discussed last time, this k, so the reason I'm writing it as a sum is because, so if I use periodic boundary conditions, which means I assume that my system is actually has a topology of a torus, right, then the components of k are actually quantized. So k mu is equal to 2 pi times some integer n mu divided by L, where L is the linear size or circumference of the torus in the muth direction. So I'll assume that circumference is the same in every direction for simplicity. And then, so due to the fact that those fields are defined on a lattice, right? K does not run from, the components of K don't run from minus to plus infinity. They're actually restricted to the first Brillouin zone. So K, the components of K are defined from minus pi over A to pi over A, where A is the lattice constant of my lattice in the Ising model. Okay? And so in the same way, I can define Fourier transforms of J and G, right? So I'll say that J I J is 1 over N, sum over Q. So I'll use Q's to distinguish it from K's for the fields, but they are the same in the sense that, they are also restricted to the first Brillouin zone. J of Q e to I Q dot Ri minus Rj. And so the reason that's very important, the reason I have this type of dependence here, that I have IQ dot Ri minus Rj, right? This just reflects the fact that due to translational symmetry of the lattice, this Jij actually depends only on the distance between the sites I and J. It does not depend on I and J separately. Okay? If it depended on I and J separately, then I would have to Fourier transform separately, with respect to I and with respect to J. Then I would have two Q's correspondingly here, right? And things would be more complicated. I mean, in this case, Fourier transform would not be useful. Okay? So this, in fact, is the reason why we can solve this problem by Fourier transform. Yeah?
So J depends only on the difference, right? Then
Yeah.
your J of Q should depend only on the norm of Q.
No, so no, so if see if J depended separately on I and J, right, then I would have two Qs actually, right? I would have to Fourier transform with respect to I and with respect to J.
Okay, so isn't the same that saying that your J of Q depends only on the relative distance of the Qs as well?
No, 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 it's not the same, no. And then, so I can say the same thing about Gij, about the correlation function. So that will also depend only on the distance between the sides for the same reasons that the system is translationally invariant. So I have sum over Q, G of Q, E to I, Q dot Ri minus Rj, right? And so let me, and you know, so the prefactors here, the fact that I have 1 over root n here, but 1 over n here, that's just convention. The reason I'm choosing them is because then, you know, the Fourier transform and the inverse Fourier transform is going to be defined symmetrically. Okay. So in particular, from here, for example, J of Q is just equal to 1 over n. Sum of over I and J, J I J, now e to minus I Q dot R I minus R J. So the exact form of the prefactor is not important. You just have to choose one convention and then follow it. Okay, so now let me take these Fourier transforms for G and J. And substitute them in here, right? So what am I going to get? So let me actually just it's going to be convenient to rewrite this equation explicitly in terms of Gij here. Just get rid of that delta function or Kronecker delta. So I have Gij minus 1 over t. Sum over L, J I L, G L J, and this is equal to delta I J. Okay, so now let me substitute the Fourier transforms. So I have 1 over N, sum over Q, G of Q, E to I, Q dot R I, minus Rj for the first term. Then I have minus 1 over t, right? Sum over L. Then I have, so two Fourier transforms for J and G. So I have 1 over n, sum over, let's say, Q prime, J of Q prime, E to I Q prime dot R I minus R L. And then I have a second Fourier transform for G. So I have times another 1 over N, sum over Q, let's say double prime, G of Q double prime, E to I Q double prime dot R J minus R L. And then, so the Fourier transform of delta function, as we discussed, this is just a constant, right? 1. So I have 1 over N, sum over Q, E to I Q dot R I minus R J. Okay? Okay, now, so as we discussed last time in doing Fourier transforms, pretty much all you know is that, all you need to know is that 1 over N, sum over L, so in this case, E to minus I Q prime minus Q double prime times RL, that's going to be a Kronecker delta of Q prime and Q double prime. Yeah.
Is there a physical interpretation of the GQs? Can we look at them as correlations between modes?
Yeah, yeah. So GQs are correlations between modes at Q and minus Q, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. So in fact, you know, later we will mostly be dealing with GQs,
okay,
with modes in Fourier space rather than with fields in real space. Okay, so again, so we have 1 over n sum over L e to minus I q prime minus q double prime dot r l. This is equal to delta q prime and q double prime, right? And so then this equation simplifies. So I have 1 over n sum over q g of q e to I q dot ri minus rj. Then, so here I have only one of the q's, only summation over single q. Let me call it q as well as here. So I have minus 1 over t times 1 over n sum over q j of q times g of q, and also the same exponential, right? And sorry, I screwed up here. This should be r l minus r j, right? Because it's g l j. So then I have e to I q dot ri minus rj equals 1 over n sum over q e to I q dot ri minus rj, okay? And so for this to be true, right, we have to have the coefficients of those exponentials be equal, right, for every q. So it follows that g of q minus 1 over t g of q times j of q is equal to 1, right? So this complicated matrix equation becomes a simple algebraic equation. Okay, and I guess the reason is translational symmetry. So the reason that happens is translational symmetry. If I didn't have translational symmetry, then, you know, it was a matrix equation in real space, it would become the same matrix equation in momentum space, in the wave vector space. Fourier transform would not help. Okay? Okay, so the solution then is G of Q is equal to 1 minus j of q divided by t, okay? So a very simple solution, but so it depends on this Fourier transform of the interaction between the spins, j of q. So that in principle depends on the specific form of the interactions, right? But so what I'm gonna show now is that in fact, in the case that interests us, namely in the case when we are looking at correlations at large distances, right? In fact, this has a very simple and universal form, which only depends on a couple of parameters. Okay, okay. So let me now calculate this Fourier transform of the interaction between the spins. Erase this thing. Okay, so what is J of Q? J of Q is equal to 1 over n sum over I and J jij e to minus I q dot ri minus rj. Now, so as I said, we are interested primarily in correlations at long distances, right? So the reason is that, as we will see, what happens at a continuous phase transition is that correlations between fluctuations of the spins grow. And that precisely is the reason of universality at such continuous phase transitions, because then, you know, when spins are correlated at long distances, the microscopic details of your system don't matter anymore, okay? So we are interested in Gij for large separation between I and J. And then, so for such long correlations, right, what matters then is the small q components, Fourier components of J of Q, right? So you know, long distances in Fourier space means small wave vectors. Because, you know, wave vector is 2 pi divided by the wavelength, right? So small wave vector means long wavelength. So we are interested in small qs. So more specifically, qs distances larger than the typical range of this interaction, which will normally be of the order of the lattice spacing, right? So long distances means greater than typical range of Jij. Let me call this R, capital R, and that will typically be of the order of the lattice spacing, right? So, for example, if you have if the sizing model describes actually interaction between spins, right, magnetic moments in a solid, then you know that interaction will fall off exponentially, because the interaction depends on the overlap of wave functions of the electrons at neighboring atoms. Right, and so that implies small q's, right? Namely, q's that we are interested in, q times r is going to be much less than 1. Okay, in such a case, I can just expand here this exponential in Taylor series with respect to q, and leave only the leading non-vanishing order. So let me do this expansion. So J of Q is going to be approximately equal to 1 over m sum over I and J. Well, so the first term is just, I just set Q to 0. So this is J I J, right? But I want to expand a little longer to a few more orders. So the next order term is going to be minus, let me actually pull Jij in front. So Jij, and I have 1 minus IQ dot RI minus RJ, right? So now this term, when I sum over all I's and J's, is going to vanish, right? And the reason is, is inversion symmetry of the lattice, right? The any, let's say, plus X direction is equivalent to minus X direction. So therefore, nothing can depend on Q, right? Because Q chooses a specific direction. So this is going to be 0 when summed over I and J. And then the second term is minus Q dot RI minus RJ, minus because of the I. So I guess 1/2 minus 1/2 Q dot RI minus RJ squared. Okay. And I'll stop at second order. So this term will already be non-zero.
And then just, are we explicitly saying J I J is symmetric?
Yeah, that's another way of to say that, you know, both positive and negative directions are equivalent, right? So this just follows from the fact that Jij is equal to Ji. Yeah. Okay. So now, so this sum, right, 1 over n, sum over I and J, Jij, this simply gives me this parameter J from the mean field theory, right? So this is equal to J. And then, so this sum, you have to do a little bit of work, couple of lines, maybe 2-3 lines to show it, but I'll just write down the answer. It's really simple, okay? So it turns out that this sum is equal to minus so minus 1/2, another constant which I will call curly capital K, times magnitude of Q squared, where curly K is equal to 1 over N times D, where D is the dimension of space, and then sum over I and J, Jij times modulus of Ri minus Rj squared, okay? It's really simple. It's again, just so you just have to use pretty much this this symmetry property of the interactions, and you will see that in fact this term is proportional simply to Q squared. Okay? Yeah.
I just want to make sure I understand the logic of what's going on exactly. So the point is we're only interested in the correlation function near the phase transition.
Well, yeah. So we are interested in the correlation function at long distances, right?
Right.
And the reason is that yes, that we are interested in things that happen near phase transitions where correlations are long, and in fact, it's fluctuations at you know, this long wavelength, as we will see, that are responsible for the properties of the of phase transitions that we are interested in, for the universal properties of phase transitions.
I just want to make sure I said, well, why this expansion is bad.
This expansion is bad. So okay, so mathematically, long distances means distances long compared to the typical range of this interaction, right? So in Fourier space, that translates into momenta or wave vectors, which are small compared to 1 over the range of the interaction. So the point is that so Gij is some function of the distance between I and J, right? And so we are interested in how that function behaves at large separation between I and J. For that, only the small Fourier components are important.
But so we're just looking at the part we care about.
Yeah, okay. It would be good, of course, calculate this correlation function at short distances, but that would not be universal. That would depend on microscopic details of our model, which we are not interested in. Yeah.
Here you're considering the interaction just to nearest neighbors. I mean, by saying
not necessarily, but yeah. So
I mean,
it's
saying that the range of your interaction is of the order of the length scale that you have.
Well, yeah, basically.
So in the case that I would say, for example, I want that the interaction of every spin is the same when I have, for example, long range interactions. So
right.
Gij is just k.
Right.
Then my j of q will be a delta function, right? So in this case,
mean field, and as you've seen, I guess already, mean field theory is exact in this case.
So I'll get the correlation function, the exact correlation function, when I have long range interactions.
Yeah.
And how does it compare to the other one? Is it the same or?
How does it compare to what?
That we're going to calculate.
So what we are calculating is correlation function in mean field theory. So it's going to be the same.
So what's the parameterless J on the right-hand side compared to J of Q on the other side?
Sorry, say it again.
Sorry, so you have J of Q equals J minus half K Q squared.
Yeah.
There's two J's. What's the difference between those two J's?
Oh, sorry. So this J is simply the J that we used in when we discussed mean field theory, right? So this is sum over J. It's sum over J, J, I, J. Okay, so we had this parameter in mean field theory, right? So this is simply the critical temperature of the Ising model in mean field theory. It's position independent because of the translational symmetry, right? So for every, if I take any site I and sum over j's, then again, I get this parameter, and it's the same for all sites I, right? Okay? So another thing here is that, so I said that I want the interaction to be short range enough that this is finite, right? But so there is actually a stronger requirement. I want this to be also finite, right? So you see that this actually places an even stronger requirement on how short range J and J is, right? I want this to be finite as well. Okay? So then you see that in this limit, when Q is small, actually it's the Fourier transform of J of Q has this very universal form, right? It's some constant minus another constant times Q squared, right? So what is the, you know, what is the physical meaning of this form? So why is it that, you know, I have something minus KQ squared? So basically the meaning of this term, right? This is basically the energy of interactions between spins when all the spins are looking in the same direction. Right, because in the Ising model I have, you know, minus j sigma I sigma j, minus j j sigma I sigma j, but when they are all looking in the same direction, right, this is pretty much the interaction energy per spin, right? Now this term, right, this term expresses the reduction of this energy when the spins are not all looking in the same direction, right? When you create some kind of a texture of those spins with wave vector Q, right? So they are not all in the same direction, and therefore the interaction energy is reduced by this amount. Okay, and the fact that this expansion starts from Q squared again is the expression of symmetry. It's the fact that all directions on the lattice are equivalent. Okay, so it cannot depend on first order of Q, right? It has to start with Q squared. And another thing is that, so the reason that it only depends on Q squared, right? So, you know, in principle, let's say I start with a, let's say in two dimensions with a square lattice, right? And of course on a lattice, okay, so the X and Y directions are equivalent. But the x direction is not obviously not equivalent to this direction, right? So in principle, you know, strictly speaking, on a lattice, I should have something like, you know, qx squared plus qy squared minus, I don't know, something times qx qy, right? But the reason that I have only q squared is that at long distances, the structure of the lattice becomes unimportant, okay? And then everything becomes simply spherically symmetric. Okay, so then, so let me plug this into the solution for the correlation function. So I have G of Q is equal to 1 minus 1 over T J of Q. And so this is 1 minus J divided by T. and then plus plus 1 over 2t k times q squared, right? And let me also use the fact that j is simply the tc, right? The mean field tc. So then this is going to be 1 minus tc divided by t plus 1 over 2t k dot q squared, right? Okay, so now to find the form of the correlation function in real space, I have to Fourier transform this back to real space, okay? So I'm not going to go through all the details, but just kind of sketch the calculation. So Gij, right, the correlation function in real space, is going to be 1 over n sum over q g of q e to I q dot Ri minus Rj. So now, as I said, you know, when dealing with these Fourier transforms in general, it's convenient to have sums over Q. But when we actually want to calculate that Fourier transform, we want to transform that sum to an integral. Okay? So how do we do that? So for that, I'm going to use the fact that so these wave vectors Q, right, their components are quantized in such units, right? So what it means is that the distance between neighboring values of q, right, is equal to 2 pi divided by l, right? So that means that I have a volume of volume equal to 2 pi to the d, dimension of space, divided by L to the d, right, per one value of q in the wave vector space, right? Per q in wave vector space, right? So therefore, to transform this sum into an integral, right, I have to so I can write an integral d dq, but then I have to divide by this volume per state in the wave vector space, right? So I have 1 over n sum over q. This can be transformed into 1 over n integral d dq, and then I have this 2 pi to the d divided by l to the d. Now, so l to the d is the total volume of the system, right? And n is the number of sides, right? Therefore, l to the d divided by n, this is simply the volume of the unit cell in real space, which is a to the d, right? So this is equal to a to the d integral d dq 2 pi to the d, okay? So this is how we will always make transformations from sums over wave vectors to integrals, okay? Again, this may be, you know, this 2 pi to the d may be a slightly different convention from what you use, let's say, in quantum field theory for your momentum integrals. You may use d over 2, for example. But that's just a convention. Okay. So I have then G I J is equal to a to the d integral d d q 2 pi to the d g of q e to I q dot r I minus r j. And now, so in principle, I could do this in a general dimension, but let me just, for simplicity, do this in three dimensions. And then we will, when we get the result, we'll generalize it easily to an arbitrary dimension. So let's set G equal 3. So then I have Gij is A cubed, G3Q, 2 pi cubed, right? G of Q, E to I, Q dot Ri minus Rj, right? So now, so G of Q, right, depends only on the magnitude of Q, right? So the Fourier transform is spherically symmetric in the wave vector space. So therefore, you know, convenient coordinates to calculate this integral as spherical coordinates, right? And so the only thing that sets the direction here is this direction of Ri minus Rj. So therefore, I will pick spherical coordinates with the z-axis along Ri minus Rj. So then, where is this? So what I get then is Gij is A cubed divided by 8 pi cube. Then I have integral from 0 to 2 pi d phi, where phi is the azimuthal angle in this spherical coordinates. Integral from 0 to pi, so sine, so d theta sine theta, where theta is the polar angle, right? And then integral from 0 to infinity dq times q squared. So g of q, and then e to I magnitude of q times magnitude of Ri minus Rj times cosine of the azimuthal angle, or of the polar angle. Okay? Okay, so let me just do the angular integral and then the integral over q you can do yourself of the magnitude of q. So the integral over theta, you know, so this is d cosine theta. So this just gives me sine of q times Ri minus Rj, right? So this is equal to, and nothing depends on phi, that just gives me 2 pi. So I get A cubed divided by 4 pi squared, right? And then I get actually by 2 pi squared, because 1/2 also goes into this sine. And then I have integral from 0 to infinity dq times q squared sine of q times Ri minus Rj divided by q Ri minus Rj, right? And then times g of q, which is so 1 minus tc divided by t plus 1 over 2t curly k times q squared, okay? And this integral over the magnitude of q is done by, you know, in the standard way, by the contour integration, right? You can transform it into an integral from minus to plus infinity, and then what matters are the poles, poles of this function here, right? So I'll just write down the answer. So the only thing I want you to notice is that, so this q squared, so q has dimensions of inverse length, right? So q squared is inverse length squared, right? So therefore, you know, so this thing divided by the coefficient of Q squared must have also have dimensions of inverse length squared, right? And so the result of this integration over Q is going to be an exponential of minus this distance, this length, right, divided by this length. Okay? Or do you want me to do the integral? Or is this fine? Yeah.
I just had a quick question about the limits of integration. I'm kind of confused, first of all, why we're taking it from 0 to infinity when we were only
right.
small q.
Right. Well, I mean, the reason is, so the since the integral converges, we are okay.
Oh, okay. And then, isn't q periodic?
Again, yeah. So in principle, what I should be doing is doing the integral from 0 to, you know, pi over a. Or pi over a, whatever. That's of something of order 1 over a. That's the magnitude of q. But since the integral converges, you know, I can just extend the upper limit of the integration to infinity. And so what the reason is that so there is another length here, which is this length that enters into the denominator of that of g of q, right? And that length, as we will see near the transition, is going to be much, much longer than a. Okay, so that's the reason I can just extend the range of the integration to infinity. Otherwise, you know, if I was interested in the correlation function at small distances, well, then, first of all, I would not be able to actually expand in Q, but then I'd also have to take this integral from, you know, between 0 and the actual limit. Okay, let me just write down the answer. This is, I mean, you can do this maybe in your tutorial if this is necessary, but this, okay, yeah, but this is really simple, okay? So the answer has the following form. So it's a cubed t. So this is just a coefficient. That's really not important. And then the important part is this. So e to minus ri minus rj divided by xi, and I'll say what xi is in a second, divided by ri minus rj magnitude, okay? And then xi is precisely that length that appears here. So xi is equal to square root of curly k. So this k, by the way, so it's sometimes it's called spin stiffness, right? And that's because, so as I discussed, you know, this basically measures how difficult it is to make spins deviate from perfect arrangement. What is the associated energy cost? So it's k divided by twice t minus tc. Okay. So this is called correlation length for obvious reasons, because that's the characteristic length on which the fluctuations of spins are correlated, right? Correlation length. And so we see that, ignoring this prefactor, which is really unimportant. So g of r, let me call r this distance between the spins, just not to write, you know, ri minus rj. So g of r behaves in the following universal way, okay? At long distances, it's e to minus r divided by xi divided by r, okay? Now, so that form is the form for three dimensions for d equals 3. So in general, it's d minus 2, okay? So d minus 2 in mean field theory, but in fact, we will see later that there can be a correction to this scaling this correction is called eta, and this is another critical exponent. It's called an anomalous dimension. Anomalous but the most important thing, of course, is how psi scales with the distance to the critical temperature, right? And so from here we see that I can say that psi, the correlation length, goes as T, right, the reduced temperature to the power minus nu. Okay, where nu is in mean field theory it's equal to 1/2. So in general, this is the correlation length critical exponent. Okay. And so this is probably, you know, the most important property of second order phase transitions, that the correlation length diverges at the transition. Okay. Yeah.
So here appears to be that we're calculating the correlation function from going from low temperature to the critical.
Yeah. So what? So we've calculated it specifically for the case T greater than TC, right? So in fact, you get the same result when T is less than TC.
Okay. Where does that assumption come into play here?
The assumption comes into when I wrote down the equation for G in real space, I explicitly assume that T is greater than TC, because in principle G dependent on the value and the magnitude of the order parameter. There was a term there that was proportional to m squared, so I've neglected that. But in fact, you know, that's really not important. So you'll find that if you do this calculation below TC, as long as it's close to the critical temperature, you'll get the same shape for G of Q, except the order of T and TC will be reversed. It will be not T minus TC, but TC minus T.
So you're saying here that we're calculating this near the critical point.
Yeah.
But near the critical point, doesn't the correlation function decay algebraically instead of?
It decays algebraically exactly at the critical point, right? So exactly at the critical point, the correlation length is infinite,
yeah.
Right? And then it's algebraic, right? So that just expresses the fact that at the critical point, so the correlation length goes to infinity, so there is no length scale anymore. Right? And so you just get a simple power law. Okay? But so this is really the most important property of second order phase transitions and the reason for their universality, right? So since the correlation length diverges near a phase transition, so basically the microscopic details which happen on small length scales of the order of the lattice spacing become unimportant. They kind of get averaged out. What is important near a continuous transition is what's happening on this length scale. Okay. So this is basically the origin of the universal behavior near continuous phase transitions, this divergence of the correlation length. Okay. And again, so the value, the specific value of this correlation length critical exponent is incorrect. It's not really 1/2. So what's captured correctly by the mean field theory is the fact that correlation length diverges as such a power law. Okay. Okay. So now, so far, you know, we've been talking about mean field theory exclusively, right? So even with this functional integral formalism, I have only done mean field theory, right? So now let's the real value of that formalism is that it allows us to go beyond mean field theory. So now let's try to make the first step beyond mean field theory and calculate fluctuation corrections to mean field theory and see basically see what happens, see whether mean field theory is meaningful or not. So basically, what you, if you find that fluctuation corrections are small, then it means that mean field theory works. However, if they are not small, and we of course we will find that they are not small, then it means that mean field theory is incorrect. Okay. What we'll find is that if we get close enough to the critical point, mean field theory is always incorrect. Okay. So let me erase this. Okay, so how do I go beyond mean field theory? So I have my representation of the partition function in terms of functional integral d phi e to minus s of phi, and so far I have approximated this integral just by e to minus s of whatever phi minimizes this section, right? But so what I want to do now is calculate that you know, quadratic fluctuation correction. Right, so you remember that when you actually evaluate an integral by the saddle point method, the result is what you do is expand this function, right, near its minimum. So I have integral from minus infinity to infinity dx e to minus f of 0 minus 1 half f double prime of 0 x squared, right? So far we have ignored that term, right? But in fact, so even if you evaluate the integral by the saddle point, you want to know what that correction from the second derivative is, right? So I have 2 pi f double prime of 0 times e to minus f of 0. We've only taken into account this term. Now I want to calculate that prefactor and see if the whole procedure makes sense, right? If I find that this prefactor is finite, then a mean field theory, at least qualitatively, is correct. But if I find the contradiction, meaning that this prefactor is not finite, then it means that mean field theory fails, right? My assumption that I can do this kind of expansion is failing. And indeed, we will find that that it will fail. Okay? Okay, so what I want to do now is then expand that action, S of phi, around the mean field solution, right? And so I have S of phi. So this is approximately equal to S of phi bar. That's my mean field constant solution. And then plus, so the leading correction is quadratic because the first derivative of phi is 0 at phi bar, right? So plus 1 half sum over I and j of the second derivative of s with respect to phi I and phi j, delta phi I times delta phi j, and so on, where delta phi I is the deviation of phi I from its mean field value, right? So this is phi I minus phi bar. Okay, so I need to calculate this this matrix of second derivatives of the action now, right? So the action is equal to 1 over 2t sum over I and j phi I j I j inverse phi j, and then minus sum over I log of twice hyperbolic cosine phi I divided by t, okay? So now let me replace all phi i's by phi bar plus delta phi I and expand to second order, okay? So this is going to be 1 over 2t sum over I and j. So phi bar plus delta phi I j I j inverse phi bar plus delta phi j, and then minus sum over I log twice hyperbolic cosine phi bar plus delta phi I divided by t, right? So the leading term when delta phi's are set to zero is just S of phi bar. That's the mean field value of the action. I'll just leave it like that, S of phi bar, right? So then I'll have first order terms. So plus 1 over t sum over I and j phi bar j I j inverse delta phi I, let's say. And I, so I've written in this form, just using the fact that using the fact that j I j is equal to j j I, right? And simply renaming the summation variables from I to j. Now the first order term from here, so it's just the derivative of this log of hyperbolic cosine, that's a hyperbolic tangent, right? So I have minus 1 over t sum over I hyperbolic tangent of phi bar divided by t times delta phi I. And now you see that the, so if I collect all the terms proportional to the first order of delta phi I, right, this is nothing but the mean field equation. The coefficient of delta phi I is simply the mean field equation, right, which is satisfied, and therefore the first order terms cancel as they should. Okay, so those two terms simply cancel. And then I have the second order terms. And so the second order terms give me, so there is one from here. So this is equal to, let me go here, actually. So I have plus 1 over 2t sum over I and j delta phi I j I j inverse delta phi j, right? And then there is a second order term from here which is proportional to the second derivative of log of hyperbolic cosine, or first derivative of the hyperbolic tangent, which is 1 minus hyperbolic tangent squared, okay? So the second order term is going to be, the second term will be minus 1 half sum over I. So 1 minus hyperbolic tangent squared of phi bar divided by t, right? And then times, so delta phi I divided by t squared, right? And let me also use here, again, the mean field equation, right? Which is just phi bar equals j times hyperbolic tangent of phi bar divided by t, right? So therefore, this is simply phi bar divided by j, right? So this is 1 minus phi bar divided by j squared, okay? And so that's what we care about. This is the action for effective action, or the action for fluctuations at second order, right? So let me write this in a more compact form. Let me introduce the following matrix. I call this capital A, IJ. And so it's going to be 1 over T, JIJ inverse, and then minus this thing, so minus 1 minus phi bar divided by j squared, right, times 1 over t squared, and delta I j, right? So then my S of phi becomes S of phi bar plus 1 half sum over I and j delta phi I a I j delta phi j, right? And so what we want to do now is integrate over those fluctuations of phi, okay? And we can do this integral because it's just a multidimensional version of the Gaussian integral, right? Multidimensional version of the integral of e to minus x squared from minus infinity to infinity, okay? So I have z now. So this is equal to e to minus S of phi bar, right? That's this thing. And then integral d delta phi e to minus 1 half sum over I and j delta phi I a I j delta phi j. Right? And this is simply equal to 1 over the square root of the determinant of the matrix A. Okay? So that's just a generalization of this thing, right? And possibly I'm neglecting factors of 2 pi here. Okay, so this is simply equal to 1 over square root of the determinant of A, e to minus s of phi bar, okay? So now, so let me calculate then the free energy, right? If I want to look at the effect of those fluctuations on thermodynamics of my system, I want to calculate the free energy. So, let's move the front down. So I have F equals minus T log Z, right? And so I will get a term t times s of phi bar from here, and this is just the mean field part of the free energy. That's the free energy we minimize with respect to phi bar to get the equation for phi bar, right? So let me just, we are not interested in that right now, so I'll just write it as f mean field, let's say, right? And then I have the contribution of fluctuations, and that's equal to plus 1 over 2t, plus t divided by 2, right? And then log of the determinant of A. Okay? Now, so for any matrix, log of the determinant is equal to trace of the logarithm, right? So log of the determinant of A is equal to trace, let me not use brackets, trace of log of A. I mean, the easiest way to see this is, so the both determinant and the trace are basis independent, right? So I can just as well calculate this in the basis in which the matrix A is diagonal, right? So then determinant is simply product of the eigenvalues, right? But log of the product is sum of logs, right? So this is precisely what this is saying. So this is equal to f mean field plus t over 2 trace of the logarithm of A. Now, so let me just massage A into a slightly different form, because we will see that, in fact, A is proportional to the inverse of the correlation function that we've already calculated. Okay? So I have A ij, so this is equal to 1 over t j ij inverse minus 1 over t squared 1 minus phi bar divided by j squared times delta ij. And so let me, just as in the calculation of the correlation function, let me for simplicity assume that I am doing the calculation when t is greater than tc, okay? So in fact, the result is exactly the same below tc, okay? Just I don't want to be carrying around this phi bar squared, okay? So let me then, phi bar then is just equal to 0. So I just have 1 here, okay? This is 1 over t j ij inverse minus delta ij divided by t squared, right? And then you see that this is simply equal to, so this is equal to 1 over t, right? So if I write this so let me do the following. Let me pull this. Let me multiply. Let me pull this g ij inverse here. To the right, let's say, in front of the brackets. So then I will get 1 over t let's see how do I write this. So 1 over t, let's say sum over L, right? Delta I L minus G I L divided by t times j inverse lj, right? And this you can recognize as the inverse of the correlation function, right? So this is just G I L inverse. Okay, so in fact, A, matrix A, is just equal to 1 over T G inverse times J, okay? So now, so I have my free energy is F min field plus T over 2 trace of log of 1 over T G minus 1 times J. And let me now use the fact that log of a product is, yeah.
Just J or J inverse?
J inverse, sorry. Let me use the fact that log of a product is sum of logs, which is also true for matrices, right? So I get F min field plus T over 2 trace of log of G inverse, and then plus T over 2 trace of log of J inverse divided by t, okay? And this thing I'm going to ignore, right? Because this depends smoothly on t, which means that it's not going to be of any importance as far as what's going on at the critical temperature is concerned, okay? So let me, it's not zero, but let me just ignore it, okay? Or you can just, we can just absorb this into F min field is going to result in some qualitative but not quantitative corrections to things. Okay? What we are interested in is really this thing. So let me just ignore this. Okay. Okay, so what I want to do now is calculate something. Some physically measurable quantity using this free energy, right? And see what kind of correction we can get compared to the result for this physically measurable quantity from mean field theory. Okay? And so it's convenient to pick the specific heat. So remember that in mean field theory, the specific heat had this jump at the critical temperature of magnitude which is of order one. Then we can easily compare, right? We have something of order one from mean field theory. If we get something that's also of order one or less than one from here, then mean field theory is fine. But if we get something much larger, then it's not fine. Okay, so let's see what we get. Let's calculate the specific heat. So let me just focus now on this part of the free energy. Let me call this delta F. So this is the correction to the free energy due to fluctuations around mean field. So T over 2 trace of log of the inverse of the correlation function, right? And then the correction to the specific heat, delta CV, is going to be proportional to the it's going to be equal to the second derivative of delta F, right? So it's minus 1 over n T d2 delta F dt squared, okay? So, let me skip the details of actually evaluating the second derivative of this log of g minus 1. They are simple. right? So the result I get, and yeah, so another thing is, so how do I calculate this trace of log of G inverse, right? So, well, the easiest way to do that is, of course, diagonalize the matrix G, right? And as we have seen in the calculation of G, what diagonalizes G is Fourier transform, right? So that's another way to think about the meaning of the Fourier transform. That's just diagonalization of the matrix G. So G of Q are the eigenvalues of the matrix G. So then this trace of log simply becomes T over 2 sum over Q of log of G inverse, G inverse of Q. Right? Okay. Okay, and so let me skip the details of taking the second derivative. So after I take the second derivative, I get the following expression for delta CV. Let me just write it down. I get delta CV equals 1 over 2n sum over Q, and then I have J of Q divided by T divided by 1 minus J of Q divided by T and everything squared. Okay, so very simple result, right? So remember that G of Q inverse is simply 1 minus J of Q divided by T, right? So that's where all this is coming from, right? And then, so I'm going to use the small wave vector expansion of J of Q that we have found before, and then convert that sum over Q to an integral. So I'll use that J of Q is equal to J minus 1/2 K times Q squared. And then I convert, so 1 over N sum over Q to A to the D integral D GQ 2 pi to the D. Right, and here I really want to do this keeping the dimension general, because we will see that the result of this calculation depends very strongly on dimensionality. Okay. So here is this.
I'm a little confused why you can neglect the T over 2 trace ln of G inverse, J inverse over 2.
Well, because...
especially because we get terms that look like that in the delta C.
Sure, yeah. You know, the reason is that this is obviously well-behaved when T is near to C, right? It's a well-behaved function, so clearly no trouble can come from that function. You will see that, in fact, there will be a lot of trouble from this. Okay? I can just set, you know, T equals TC or in the argument of the log, and then it's just some constant basically for T near TC. Right? In this thing, we are not interested in any quantitative details, right? We are interested in qualitative behavior. We are interested in divergences of of things near critical temperature, and therefore constants we can always ignore. Okay, so what do I get then? I have delta CV, after I convert this to an integral, it's going to be equal to A to the D divided by 2. And so here, in this integral, I got to be careful with the limits. So I need actually to take into account the fact that that Q is defined only in the first Brillouin zone. Right? So I explicitly have integral from minus pi over A to pi over A for every component of Q. And I have d dq divided by 2 pi to the d. And then, so if I use that expansion, so in the numerator here, I have j of q. I will leave only the leading order term, right? I will just set q to 0. And the reason is that, as you will see, so in the denominator is going to vanish at TC, right? So I need really to keep the Q dependence, while the numerator is just something that doesn't vanish. Therefore, I can just expand only to leading order in Q. So I have J divided by T squared, right? And then here I have 1 minus j divided by t plus 1 half k, so 1 over 2 t, sorry, k times q squared, right, squared. And so it's this thing here, right, that vanishes when t is equal to tc, because this is just tc. Okay, so to calculate this integral, let me do the following. Let me introduce a dimensionless integration variable. So this is always a good idea. Whenever you calculate some integral, it's always useful to convert the integral to dimensionless variables, because often then you won't even need to do the integral. I mean, here we have to, but okay, so let me introduce dimensionless momentum. Yeah.
One thing, can you repeat why you get rid of the q squared in the numerator?
Because, well, you know, so for small q, it's a small correction to j, right?
Oh.
It's important here because here the zeroth order term is going to vanish at TC, but here it's, but in the numerator it's not. So let me introduce dimensionless wave vector. Let me call it Q capital. And this is going to be just A, the lattice constant, times the small q, right? So q has dimensions of inverse length. So A times q is dimensionless. So then, and let me also note that, so this thing divided by k, right, that's precisely 1 over the correlation length squared, right? So let me rewrite this also in terms of the correlation length squared. So then what I get is the following. So I get delta CV equals 1 half. Now the integral simply goes from minus pi to pi. I have d capital Q divided by 2 pi to the d. And I have 4 j divided by k squared times a to the fourth. But so the important thing is the, in the denominator, I'm going to get k capital Q squared plus A divided by Xi squared and everything squared. Okay, so that's the integral I want to do. Now, there is one more thing here. Well, if I probably not have time to finish this calculation, but let me just continue for a couple of more minutes. So this ratio of J over K actually has a separate meaning, right? So remember that J is equal to 1 over N, sum over I and J, Jij times R, sorry, just Jij, while K is equal to 1 over N times D, the space dimension, times sum over I and J, Jij times Ri minus Rj squared, right? So then, if I take the ratio of K divided by J, right? So this ratio has clearly dimensions of length squared, right? And that length obviously has the meaning of the effective range of interaction squared, right? So I can just define then this ratio, and let me include D into the definition, as R squared by definition, right? So this is the effective range of the interaction squared. But so this is something that's of order of A, but it can in principle be a little bit larger than A.
Sorry, what's yeah. Before the J?
Sorry? This is 4.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So let me rewrite this in terms of R now. So I have delta CV then equals, can write it in this way, 2D squared A divided by R to the fourth, and then integral from minus pi to pi d dq divided by 2 pi to the d, and then 1 over q squared plus a divided by xi squared, everything squared, okay? And okay, so let's do this, let's calculate this integral tomorrow. Okay. So what we will see, and the interesting thing that we will see, is that the result of this integration depends very strongly on dimensionality of space. Okay. So whether mean field theory works or doesn't work depends, in fact, on the dimensionality of space. Okay, so let's continue tomorrow.